Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder to my audience, we Zoom on Monday afternoon, so something should happen Monday night. We will not be discussing it. I also want to remind people that we are actually Zooming on Labor Day, so a lot of the conversation is going to focus on Labor Day, which occurred the day before. And the other thing I also want to sort of share with my audience is that we have a very late primary in New Hampshire. Our state primary is Tuesday. And there is such an uproar about what's happening between absentee balloting, in-person balloting, about mask wearing. It's a very frightening situation as we approach the election tomorrow. So there's so much on my plate. But before we get to all those things with my first guest who writes for the American Prospect, I need to remind everyone that we begin our conversations every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. You know what Donald Trump thinks of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Actually, not just Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, but anyone that enlists, anyone that serves their country. And of course, Vindman was very proud to do so and understood that he was there not to represent the president, but to represent the Constitution and to speak truth to power. So now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I feel like I keep going back to you all the time, Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson writes for the American Prospect. He is editor at large. I'm always seeking his guidance. He has been around the block for a long time, kind of like me, Harold. And so we've seen a changing nature of politics. We've seen it ebb and flow. But I think this seems to be a very, very fractious time and a very, very vulnerable time, in part because we're looking at what I call the three pandemics, the pandemic of racism, the pandemic of COVID, and the pandemic of climate change. And they're all sort of converging on us all at once, Harold. But at the same time, we actually maybe have a fourth variation on the pandemic theme, and that is our authoritarian chief, Donald Trump. And so when you sort of look at the kind of crazy cocktail we've created, it is made for, I think, an amazingly unsettled, unstable, frightening situation. And when I reached out to you, I knew that it was on Labor Day that we're going to be talking, we're Zooming. And I posted something on my Facebook page, Harold, and it was about Northeastern, who had made the decision to send a bunch of kids home because they had partied after they came to class. And they're being sent home, they're losing their tuition, they're losing their opportunity to go to school for at least a year, we think. We don't know, but in a lot of ways, they were concerned if you're gonna be coming on campus, you have to behave properly. Partying is not something you do. One of the reasons why I thought this story was so interesting is that it's not just about kids sharing COVID-19 with each other. It's about the faculty that get COVID-19. It's about the support staff, the cleaning staff, the library staff, you know, whoever, that this is about the community and frankly spreading it within the cities that house these college campuses. So Harold, I posted that story about my concern on Facebook and I got someone who responded in the form of a poem. Last night, coming home from Keene State College, we essential workers that are working our tails off and trying to keep everyone safe. And to see so many young people out acting with reckless abandon breaks my heart. That was the backstory. I asked him, why did he write this? And here's what he wrote. The moment, winding my way up Main Street, dead on my feet, roomy eyes watering, arches of my feet aching, quarter after 11 p.m., The bar named for the rocks used as pavers on English streets, pack and all, maybe 30 or 40. Little birds, like this year's young, gathering in flocks, joyous, chirping, eyes alive, animated, good to be alive, young and alive, close in together, basking in each other's company, the moment, the precious moment, no distance between, no face covering their mouths, the moment, the joyous moment. He posted it on Facebook, and I realized how vulnerable he felt. In a way, he wanted to be in that bar too, but he understands what it means to spread a disease. And for whatever reason, our young people don't seem to appreciate that it's not just about them, but it is about the rest of us, Harold. What do we do?
Well, I mean, that's a huge problem. Young people generally have a sense of immortality, and they probably don't think of other people's mortality. And to a certain degree, except in wartime when you're on the front lines, that's a bit of a natural condition of the young. And it's the problem that every college in the country, one way or another, is grappling with right now, either by not opening or opening selectively or opening non-selectively and then deciding to close. I mean, it's a huge problem. At another level, it's a problem that's been politicized since the Republicans have been taught by example by Donald Trump that wearing a mask is kind of a wussy thing to do. So, you know, Republicans over 25, this is a completely shameless position. For young people, it's less shameless than it, I think, simply is unconscious. It's not the way they interact, and they think that if they get the disease, it won't be serious. And for themselves, that's probably true. But if they convey it to someone who's older or someone with an underlying condition, then it's a problem. Of course, we had that immortal line at the Democratic convention from the young woman whose father believed Trump's assurance that it was safe to go back into the kind of setting that your poet so well described. And as she said, his only underlying condition was that he believed Donald Trump and died from it. So, you know, it's in this sense, it's sort of a generational problem, which I can understand, but it's also a political problem for their elders, and that's outrageous.
So I'm gonna say two things, because I think it's even more than that, but we haven't been maybe as vibrant about the science that we're now uncovering. And again, this is a new pandemic, this is a new disease. So every day things change because we're learning new things, all right? Yeah. So there's a couple of things I wanna start with. One, I wanna start with a civics lesson. And one of my absolute favorite quotes comes from Calvin Coolidge, believe it or not, quiet cow. And Calvin Coolidge said the following: patriotism means looking after yourself by looking after your country. Now, what I love about that quote is that he acknowledges our universal selfishness, that we care first about ourselves. But what Cal was able to do in that amazing quote is remind us that if you really give a crap about yourself, you better look outside of yourself in order to protect yourself. And whether that's true with climate change, whether that's true with, you know, economic justice, whether that's true with healthcare, I think that quote is such a powerful quote and needs to be taught to every child starting at age 5, okay? And okay, I feel like I want to go into those 18-year-olds and give them all a knuckle sandwich with my mask on and sort of say, and the other thing is, so I am not necessarily worried about whether they're going to die, okay? They may get COVID and survive. Yes, I'm worried that they could bring it into a nursing home or bring it home to their parents or make the guy at the 7-Eleven get it because they're going to go to the 7-Eleven after they leave the bar or whatever, the people that are working at Keene State College, for example. But what we are uncovering, Harold, is that even people that don't exhibit any real signs of having contracted COVID may have long-term physical consequences as a result of this disease. This is not the flu. This is not the sniffles. The fact that you don't experience something doesn't mean you don't have some kind of liver damage or neurological damage. And in a lot of ways, we haven't even talked a lot about that because we're fighting the mask wars, because we're fighting Donald Trump. So as I read this poem and I thought about Northeastern and I thought about Keene State College, I was weeping because in a lot of ways, everything around us is reinforcing the bad behavior of our 19-year-olds because nobody is being brutally honest and establishing what real parameters are to keep us all safe and open up the economy.
Indeed. I mean, amen. I have really nothing to add to that. We don't know the long-term consequences of this disease. For young people, since they don't know it, that's just one level of ignorance in a non-pejorative sense that is compounded by what it is to be a young person. So it's tragic in that sense.
It is tragic. So let's get into a Labor Day conversation because today is Labor Day. Dean Baker from the CEPR tweeted something out the other day, and he gave us a fun fact, and I actually used it on Sunday as well. And that was that if we had been keeping up with the increase in the minimum wage today would be $24 an hour. 24, that's his fun fact, okay? That was from Dean Baker. And I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, we are going to see an even more grotesque economic divide because of the pandemic. Because those that have to be on the front line, whether it's, you know, union workers that are nurses, firefighters, whatever, the people at the meatpacking plants, the people at the grocery stores, we can't even pay them enough for the kind of risk that we're asking them to take. And then on top of that, people now are able to figure out that they can work remotely. They may still get their old paycheck, but guess what? They won't need that car anymore. They won't have to pay for the gas. They won't have to pay for the parking. They won't have to pay for all these things, Harold. And all of a sudden now, they will be even richer. And those that are risking everything will be even more at sort of on the vulnerable end of the spectrum.
Where the gap is getting greatest is among the very rich who own stock, particularly stock in the tech monopolies, because their income and the value of their stock has soared during the pandemic as more people shop online or rely on Netflix instead of going out to the movies or what have you. You know, actually, there are only a handful of stocks that have gone up in this time period. But if you own those stocks, your wealth has hugely increased. And also the value of property has gone up or people are fleeing the cities. So people with substantial investment income have seen their income soar while the rest of the economy has been in one degree or another devastated by what's going on with us.
So how do we turn this around? Because, you know, every time I listen to Joe Biden and I'm voting for Joe and I'm going to be actively working for Joe, but I'll be honest with you. I don't know whether he really appreciates the level of vulnerability. And the reason I'm going to say that is he actually has been living on the government teat his entire life. He has only known elected office really from all of his adult life. I mean, he got elected very, very young. It has been consistently a pattern and practice. So he has never been on COBRA. He's never lost his job. He may go up for a vote, but he has never lost an election. And, you know, he's got the best healthcare in the world because it's the healthcare that Congress gets. He knows exactly what his paycheck is. And, you know, he doesn't have to worry about it going down. It only goes up slightly all the time. And he has all the perks of office. And in some ways, he's like my father. My father was a public employee. My father was a teacher, but he never lost his job as a teacher. He always had, you know, a decent salary. He always had a decent benefit package. And he never understood what it was like for me to have been on COBRA, who had lost her job, who had actually gone through long periods living with cockroaches. I mean, he couldn't believe it. He spent all this money on my going to law school, and here's his daughter without health care. Like, what was my problem? And I remember trying to explain to them, what's the economy's problem? That it wasn't my problem, it was the economy. But that's part of it, is that people don't appreciate what's really happening.
Well, I think the condition you sketch for Joe Biden is actually a condition for most elected officials who may have gone through such periods earlier in their life, but certainly aren't going through it while they're elected officials. Biden does talk about his childhood in which his father was out of work. His mother was a homemaker. So he does have that. He does have that memory. And I think what we've seen in the whole Democratic Party over the last year in particular, when we see exit polling in every Democratic primary supporting Medicare for all, is an awareness of the kind of fragility of the economy. And even if Joe Biden, like most elected officials, has been immune from experiencing that personally for the last God knows how many years, he would have to have spent the entire last 47 years, not the last 6 months, in his basement. And he has. I think he knows what's I think he knows what's going on. And I think, you know, he's certainly aware that the pandemic has wreaked havoc in the economy, which it has. There's some studies I've seen in terms of the long-term effects of this downturn that say, like, we're going to lose 4 million businesses will fail this year in the United States, and only 1.2 new businesses will be created. So you're having a massive imbalance of small businesses failing with all the dislocations that causes. And, you know, even the unemployment figures don't reflect how many people really are working part-time or you know, their pay has been cut. We know that that's happening across the board now, and it's going to keep happening. It's going to keep happening for a while. And as you suggested earlier, the inequality of both income and wealth has continued to increase. Just in the last week or two, the Economic Policy Institute has come out with its annual calculation of the ratio between average CEO pay and average worker pay, and it's 320-1. 50 years ago it was 20-1. Now it's 320-1. So this is growing, and this is more of an issue in the Democratic Party, I would suggest, than it's been since the 1930s, and it still is. So if we're concerned, and we should be, about just how progressive a Biden presidency, assuming there's a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House, would be, well, it's up to people like us and to progressive movements to help compel a more progressive response to this. But that's always been the case in politics. It was the case in the 30s, it was the case in the 60s. It needs to be the case next year, if God willing, the election turns out the way we hope it will.
So Ken, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, Harold, to the differences that you're talking about between, you know, CEO pay and average worker pay. I think that we don't talk often about what has happened to the average worker, him or herself, over the last, 30 years or more, because the average working person is not an automaker who is making decent middle income. The average working person now is, you know, a sales clerk who may be working two or three jobs, and their spouse is,
Yeah, but the average worker, Ken, has something that my parents would never do, which is have enormous credit. I mean, that is
well, that makes it worse.
That's the story, Harold.
But that was what brought about the 2008 collapse.
Yes,
was that credit on home purchases was issued widely and couldn't be met once the downturn started. Today, the level of student debt is staggering as well. It's between $1.5 and $2 trillion. So college graduates, who may have on paper a decent income, have to fork over so much of that income that it ceases to be decent.
Are we going to see a rise in unions as a result? It's as we talk about the fact that the Democratic Party is becoming more progressive, we're seeing the grotesque inequality. We realize that the only place labor unions even exist is in the public sector. When it comes to the private sector, they don't exist. But all of a sudden now, I think, are people connecting the dots? That if you don't have representation, you have no protection. If you don't band together, your employer, who's now making 320 times what you're making, doesn't give a crap about you because he's got a moat of money around him. And frankly, what you want to do is you want to swim that moat because you want to get some of that cash in your pocket because you know that 50 years ago, if it was only 20 and now it's 320, tell me how that person is that much smarter. Tell me how that person is working that much harder. I just want to know, because if they are, what kind of a schlub are you?
Yeah. Well, not only that, what kind of a schlub was a CEO 50 years ago?
Exactly.
You know, I mean,
exactly.
So, yes, we have whole gradations of schlubbiness here. Well, you know, there was a Gallup polls every Labor Day on the approval rating of unions. That came out on Friday, and it was higher than it had been in 19 years. It was up to 65%. Wow. What I found particularly interesting was that even among Republicans, it was at 45%. Now, you can't find 45% of Republican elected officials. You can't find 4.5%. You can't find 0.45% of Republican elected officials who will ever do anything that is pro-union. So I think the awareness of the necessity for unions is growing alongside the awareness of the grotesque economic inequality in the country. So that's a positive sign. It's also a positive sign that workers in the kind of few professions where they can't easily be fired if they start forming a union are unionizing in nonprofits, at universities, workers who cannot easily be replaced. The necessity, though, is changing labor law. Yes. So that all workers have that sense of security when they try to unionize. This is something that Biden is very good on in his labor plank, and every Democrat running for president over the last year was more pro-union than almost any Democrats running for president had been in the last 30 years.
Wow.
That's a function of this economic inequality argument trickling down, even to Democratic politicos, and certainly to Joe Biden. One of the labor planks of Joe Biden's labor platform that really hasn't been discussed at all, but I think
good. I'm glad we're here to talk about it.
Is he would extend the National Labor Relations Act, an improved National Labor Relations Act, to public employees everywhere. Now, right now, public employees only have the right to collectively bargain in states that permit that, which is to say, states that have, you know, have historically been Democratic run. This would extend that right to states across the country, which would significantly boost levels of unionization. So public employees like your friend at Keene.
Keene State.
And across the nation would have the right to unionize. So I think this is an important shift within the Democratic Party, which never repudiated unions, but which kind of abandoned them at the level of elected official policymaking for a good 25 years there.
So I don't know if the Pew did the poll about this, but I remember being on Fox News. Ken's heard me tell the story. I'm on Fox News, and we're talking about increasing the minimum wage. And I made the statement that every single state that has had an increase in the minimum wage, whether it was a red state or a blue state, it has passed. It is passed. And I don't care whether everyone from the governor to the legislature said, no, that the Chamber of Commerce came out with all this money against raising the minimum wage, but every friggin' state has raised the minimum wage. So the guy on Fox News said, oh, that's not true. I said, really? Fact check me now. And I made them fact check me in real time, Harold. You'll just love me. And of course, it's true. Now, the reason I say that is that it actually mirrors what you just said about 45% of Republicans support the concept of unions. So what we're finding out is, I don't want to listen to the GOP leadership. I don't want to hear what the chamber says. I don't want to hear what the elected official says. I want to know what the people actually think. So when you start talking about increasing the minimum wage, you will get the support of GOP Republicans. If you talk about unions, you'll get the support of Republicans. So I am looking at Democrats and telling them, don't be so timid.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, the fact that business and the bigger the business, the more power it has.
Yes.
The fact that business is opposed to this, they command, partly due to our campaign finance system,
exactly.
More clout, even in the Democratic Party, than they deserve. And if you're willing to go with a pro-union position and a higher minimum wage position, you know, a lot of Democrats have shown it's possible to raise small donations online if you're progressive. That's right. Where the party needs to go. And it needs to stop cowering in front of business interests that are opposed to letting workers have real power.
And, you know, in the end, I want to look at employers and say, it is better for you if there's less of an economic gap. It is better for you if people have more income because they will put it back into the economy. It is better for you. The fact that you amass mountains of cash doesn't actually have a long-term benefit for the business that you actually want to sort of support and encourage. I don't know why people are, my brother always used to tell me, diversify your portfolio, let it ride. Well, I'm thinking, okay, well, I want to say that to management. Diversify your portfolio. Don't put so much money into your own paycheck. Let it ride and invest in your workers, and then it could be a win-win. What happened to the concept, Harold, of win-win?
It lost to the concept of win-lose and the rather narrow-minded, we just want to increase our own income, screw everybody else mentality that's dominated C-suites in American corporations for at least 40 or 50, at least 40 years.
But that seems to have worked though, Harold, hasn't it? That's been successful. It's been successful for them.
But it led their nation to a very perilous condition that we're in today.
And I think that therefore, if I ever ran for president, I would run on a win-win. I would say, no, I'm not anti-business, but you know what, business? I want the other side to win too. So let's have a win-win strategy. And therefore they can't marginalize you. You know, in a lot of ways, I feel like this is what's happening with Joe Biden with the whole idea of what to do with the police. You know, Donald Trump wants to put every word into his mouth and Joe Biden is able to respond. It doesn't mean that there shouldn't be reforms. He's just not going to embrace the defund, but he wants a win-win. He wants people to feel safe and secure, and he wants to make sure the police don't kill you. I mean, I think that sounds like a pretty much of a win-win to me. On that note, Harold Meyerson, on this Labor Day, thank you so much for joining us. And I appreciate you tolerating my reading that poem at the very beginning, but—
Thank you, Arnie.
Thank you. Have a happy Labor Day, and thank you very much for joining The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It is we who plow the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We love Bob Henley. We call him all the time. We love what he writes about. We love how his mind thinks. And one of his more recent columns at insidernj.com was something that sort of caught my attention. It was entitled, 2020 Fear and Scarcity or Faith and Abundance, A Republic in the Balance. And Bob, I told you that last week we interviewed a guy named Art Cullen, a Pulitzer Prize winning writer from Iowa, Storm Lake, Iowa, as a matter of fact. And he writes for the Guardian newspaper. And I read his piece and I went, wow, there's so much good stuff in here. I want you to read the damn piece out loud, and I'm going to interrupt you. And I'm going to ask you to read Bob Hennelly's piece at Insider NJ. And I'm going to reserve the privilege of interrupting you, which you know I will do, because I think that this is an important time to look at this, because we are a republic in the balance. And I have never felt so frightened and concerned. But I am going to say something to you. Never in my life have everyone I know been talking about voting.
Right.
It's, I mean, everyone. I mean, people are stopping me on the streets. People are stopping me when I go to the grocery store. And they're asking me my thoughts. What did I think? These are people I didn't even know were, like, registered to vote.
Right.
So it's a real eclectic group of people. So I think in a funny way, people know that we are in a sense of a balance. And they're recognizing that their participation in this election is actually crucial.
Right.
I'm going to ask you to begin, and I will be prepared to interrupt. But again, your piece of Insider NJ is, I think, incredibly well written and an important piece.
Thanks so much for having me. And feel free to interrupt me. I'm counting on it.
Trust me, I'm doing it.
Every day that goes by, the fault line that defines America deepens as the dead bodies pile up around the molten divide. In the midst of a once-in-a-century pandemic that has killed hundreds of thousands of Americans and infected millions, so much of America is fixing for a fight. We are like a large extended family restricted to being indoors for too long, with some family members well-armed, willing to start shooting just to get breathing room. We can't blame Donald Trump for this national alienation, but he counts on encouraging it as the only way he can hold on to power and avoid being held accountable for decades of being above the law and corrupting every sphere within which he operated. The essence of greed, infused self-interest at the heart of Trumpism, was baked into the way we came upon the bounty that was this continent between Europe and Asia. And a deferral of the reckoning for our original national sin of slavery and all of the exploitation that has followed. It's not an aberration. The holders of white male grievance and Donald Trump are both in the lamb from the arc of justice, and they will shoot their way out of the corner history has them in. His rise to power is merely a logical progression of all that has come before, not a radical departure from it.
So let me stop you there. I think that is so important, because I've been talking to Republicans this week. The guy that I ran against for governor in 1992 died, okay? And someone said to me, well, you know, talk to me about your relationship with him. And I said, I kind of liked him. And they went, what? And then I said to a reporter who called me up, I said, when I lost, I still think I might have made a better governor, but I so desperately wanted him to succeed. And someone then said to me that he was a dying breed, that he was the last of Republicans who didn't walk in and genuflect to basically what was this sort of ideology.
Right.
And when you wrote this piece about Donald Trump, that this is the direction that they've been building in, I look at Steve Merrill, who just recently died, and I grieve even more for his death, because the timing of his death at this moment made me realize how different Donald Trump and the Republican Party has become.
Right. Right. I would say that for me here as a reporter that came up in New Jersey, the closest parallel would be Governor Tom Kaine, right?
Yeah.
Who's still with us, but who was, you know, someone that Coretta Scott King came in for, you know, I mean, that's hard to imagine that there was someone called Jacob Javits, a
right.
Republican liberal. There was diversity in the political ecology there, but that's long gone.
It's long gone. So that's why I want people to understand that this progression of Donald Trump is not a one-off. Donald Trump is kind of the icing on the cake.
Right, right.
Jacob Javits is my answer to the question when anybody says, well, Ken, you probably never even voted for a Republican. I voted for Jake Javits.
Yep, absolutely. So let's talk about the lack of upward mobility. That's
right. Okay. A lack of upward mobility and economic hardship for an ever-increasing percentage of American families for decades prompted many to finger immigrants as the cause of their deteriorating circumstance. A lot of Americans really like what Donald Trump did by separating migrant children from their parents and putting them in cages. as other commentators have expressed, the cruelty is the point.
But let me stop you there. Let me just stop you there, because here's the point. The point is the reason why they blame immigrants, the reason why they blame women or they blame African Americans is because the Republican Party made sure that the blame was diverted away from the policies that they were embracing. When you are embracing employers and shafting workers, then you want the workers to blame someone other than the employers. So right. I get why they're angry. I even understand it, but I think we have to understand that they were schooled in this. They were taught who to hate, whether it was true or not.
Right.
Oh my God.
And then you have also during the Clinton era, the embracing of global trade, the whole neoliberal construct that by making the world safe for capitalism, that people would prosper in America. And the opposite has happened.
Exactly, exactly.
Can I just add here, the last thing from your article that you read was the cruelty is the point. And that it's so true, Bob, but it's also so contrary to, we grew up believing that our country, America, is this wonderful country of good people. I remember being a kid and wondering why all these people in South America or the third world were throwing rocks and tomatoes at the U.S. limousines that drove by. Why don't they like us? We think of ourselves as good people, caring people, equality and justice and all the rest of this. And to think that now we've come to the cruelty is the point that we're trying to make. Oh, my gosh.
Well, and we think that we're a land of immigrants, and yet that's not true either, because we want to always pull up the drawbridge after the last group of immigrants come in. No, it's the Irish, it's the Italian, it's the Jews. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, they're the last. They're the seal of the prophet. After them, nobody else. I mean, it's so funny. Immigrants are fine when it's us, but when it's the next wave of immigrants, it's not so fine.
Or even that we're good Christians and we do unto others as we would have others do unto us.
Well, I would say that, you know, this all goes back to, not to go too far afield from our guided meditation, but when you deal with, you know, that thing about Christianity, it's very important to remember and put a footnote here about the doctrine of Christian discovery, which our Native American brothers and sisters will tell you was this thing in the period of time, even before America was formed into a republic, where the popes and a series of them came up with the same ruling. You had all these competing monarchies in Europe that were racing around the world to claim parts of Africa, to claim parts of what they thought was a new world. And in the process, they conferred upon them the right to own basically anything they claimed, including human beings, as long as their mandate was to bring them to Christ. And they put a crucifix on there and a Jesuit up top with the captain, and they were good to go. And that is really part of the formulation of this nation.
Yeah, I know. And of course, and you saw what just recently happened. Again, we're going off on a divergent track.
Right, right.
But I wrote a tweet and I went, well, Donald Trump is now going all white. And the reason I said that was he was basically saying, I want the 1619 project out of any schools. They're going to lose their federal funding. And then he said, all that diversity training that you've been giving within, you know, the federal employees, I want that all yanked out. I'm going, my God, he is going all white. It's just amazing. And what you just said, it seems, I mean, this again is a natural progression. I mean, Donald Trump is not a one-off, everyone. It's just amazing.
Shall we go back?
Yes, let's go back. Let's go back.
Let's not sugarcoat it. Our history is a cruel one. Trump is actually in touch with white America's dark side that's defined by grievance, scarcity, and an insatiable fear that there fundamentally isn't enough to go around.
That's right.
They have to jealously guard with their guns whatever they have, like Mark and Patricia McCluskey, the St. Louis couple who stood outside their home and trained their guns on peaceful BLM protesters back in June, who were featured during the RNC convention.
Unbelievable. All right, the next paragraph is entitled, Irish Need Not Apply. I was just talking about them. Keep going.
The notion that we ever really welcomed immigrants is a misremembering of our own history. The native people that were here first, we killed off. Then we brought in hundreds of thousands of slaves from Africa to work the land we stole from the Native Americans. We kept the descendants of our captives in chains for centuries and then beat and murdered those that tried to exercise a voting franchise. We pretended to extend them.
Oh, God, this is so depressing. All right, keep going, keep going.
Almost 20 years ago when our country was attacked and we had the sympathies of the nations of the world, we went on a global shooting spree that upended several countries that helped set off the greatest migration of refugees since the Second World War. And then faced with the misery of the human blowback of millions trying to escape the regional wars we started, we raced to close our borders.
Now you see why I wanted him to read it out loud, everyone. Oh, right, keep going, Bob. Keep going.
On the eve of the climax of the RNC's White House extravaganza, support in the right grew for a white 17-year-old armed with an AR-15 who took it upon himself to travel from another state to Kenosha, Wisconsin, to protect private property and allegedly murder two Black Lives Matter protesters in the process. The 17-year-old, who was a police cadet in his Illinois hometown, conscripted himself into Donald Trump's army that now includes New York City PBA President Patrick Lynch, the New York Jersey State Police Benevolent Association, and the International Union of Police Associations that have all endorsed the incumbent. From the press reports, this adolescent lived in a black and white world of a perennial war between the good guys and bad guys, where guns are the only tools to sort it out. Now, he will have the rest of his life to contemplate all the shades that there are in between.
And it's this story of this kid is just, and he's not a kid, he's a 17-year-old. We've decided that we treat 17-year-olds like adults. But the fact that he was a police cadet, when I read that, I almost fell off the chair. That he was a police cadet, the fact that they didn't stop him, the fact that he was able to go home and sleep in his own bed. I mean, when you kind of look at all this and begin to realize that everything about this situation is color-coded. And he has the benefit of being the right color.
And that's why the subhead
the right color.
Right. Oh, the next line is skin color passport. Oh.
Keep going.
The juxtaposition of the Kenosha police shooting of a 20-year-old Jacob Blake 7 times in the back and the way the 17-year-old white out-of-town vigilante was able to saunter past police openly carrying his rifle he had just used tells you all you need to know about our cold Civil War swing state terrain.
Keep going.
His white skin was his passport from the chaos on the streets he shot his way out of, so he could return to his neighboring state and sleep in his own bed as the families of the victims learned their loved ones would never sleep again.
Let me read this sentence again. I think so important. His white skin was his passport from the chaos on the streets he shot his way out of, so he could return to the neighboring state and sleep in his own bed as the families of his victims learned their loved ones would never sleep again. His white skin was his passport. What a brilliant line. What a brilliant line, Bob. I read that and I was shaking. I was shaking because that sort of, in a lot of ways, tells this whole story. It just does. All right, keep going.
Did you see the footage, Bob, of the night when that 17-year-old and the other vigilantes were interviewed on, they're standing in front of the gas station? I mean, he didn't seem like a kid then. He was very aggressive or assertive anyway, and going out and talking to the videographer and explaining why we're here to protect the property. As
right, it, right,
you know,
right.
He's doing the right thing and very, very self-righteous. And by the way, in terms of him shooting his way out of the chaos, he brought himself into the chaos in order to bring more firepower chaos.
Exactly.
Exactly. All right, keep going.
He was pulled into this domestic war theater conjured up by Donald Trump, who has cast himself as a tough guy, willing to do whatever it takes to restore law and order, even though he sparked the chaos in the first place. Yeah. Trump has perfected the tyrant's touch for using active duty military, law enforcement, and religious clerics as extras in his movie. He shrouds himself in the symbols of righteous piety, even as he instigates the violent disintegration of the nation that he needs to whittle down so he can pocket it.
Oh, God. All right. This is the title of the next paragraph is unbelievable. Dowser of Divides. Boy, where do you come up with this stuff? That's the best alliteration I've heard. Dowser of Divides. Okay, shoot, Bob Henley.
He's a dowser of divides, exploiting the alienation between much of the American labor movement that's been supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement and those police unions who now have flocked to his side looking for cover. Make no mistake, this presages just how he could get reelected. which would be the crowning success of Vladimir Putin's installation of a red, white, and blue authoritarianism. Oh. Donald Trump's worldview got a big boost from the appearance of Cardinal Timothy Dolan at the RNC. New York's leading prelate prayer invoked the imagery of our, quote, troubled cities and the police who guard them, close quote. Close your eyes and you can see that video of Trump standing in front of St. John's Church holding a Bible as a prop after U.S. police and military forces used force to clear Lafayette Square of peaceful protesters.
So I'm going to stop you here because as I was reading this paragraph, the Dowser of Divide, this is not a new concept for Donald Trump. And I don't mean just Donald Trump. I mean the governor of Wisconsin. When he was fighting the unions, he divided the unions. Right. There were the police and firefighters on one side, and then there was everyone else, the teachers and all the other unions. And that is exactly how he, even though they were trying to take him out, how he stayed in office was by dividing the unions. And so once again, you see what he was doing, using the police and the firefighters, and Donald Trump is doing the exact same thing. So instead of these unions coming together and understanding that they're being played, they in fact are willing accomplices to being played.
Well, and so one of these things that would be instructive is to look at what has happened if it's true that Donald Trump believes that blue lives matter. Well, look at what he's done in terms of his lack of an integrated COVID response. It has resulted, as Vice President Biden pointed out, in far more police officers getting killed from COVID than being shot. And literally thousands of essential workers and first responders who have died as a consequence of Trump's really a policy that has actually spread the disease rather than contained it.
So I've been dying to ask someone this question, and because you're discussing this right now about the police unions and does he believe in these blue lives matter? He doesn't, because if we believe the new book about Donald Trump and the military and how much disdain he has and how he thinks that they're kind of schmucks and why would they enlist and why would they do this and why would they put their life on the line and why didn't they go after the money? Doesn't he kind of think the same thing about the cops? Isn't he kind of, I see him using the police the same way he uses the military. He doesn't have faith in them. He doesn't believe in them. He doesn't support them. He thinks they're kind of jerks, but they're his jerks for now because he can use them to work the divide. And I don't see how the police don't see themselves as being any different from how he actually has this disrespect for the U.S. military. To me, it's a continuum.
Well, it's also important if you have the kind of daily interaction I do with both civil servants and with law enforcement.
Right.
Many of them are veterans. Many of them remain active duty veterans and appear to active duty soldiers. So in this period of time, we can talk about some other time, a voluntary military, which is something we've done for a while now. There's a culture of service, and the latest disclosures, both in the Atlantic and then the book, talking about this sense that people that serve altruistically are losers or suckers. Well, truly, the essential workforce is a whole army of losers and suckers who leave their home, put themselves at risk to feed their family, loser, and the entire community to make sure you get your breakfast. Now,
Right there for Salon. I want people to understand these cops are they're pawns. He does see them as losers and suckers, but right now he's using them and elevating them. And they're what are they doing? They're aiding and abetting Donald Trump when his disdain for them is the same as his disdain for the military. Unbelievable, unbelievable, Bob. All right, keep going. I'm sorry. I finally had someone that I could sort of riff with about this because it's been driving me nuts that they don't know how they're being played.
Historically, dictators can only successfully consolidate their grasp on power when they co-opt the symbols of law enforcement and religion, making it possible to extend their dominion over the here and now, along with claims on the hereafter. What better way to obscure his own crime wave and malfeasance in failing to execute a coherent national public health response to a virus that's killed close to 200,000 Americans than by getting the imprimatur from the police unions and America's cardinal primetime blessing. What appears to be of no consequence to the police unions that they have endorsed Donald Trump is his attack on the American labor movement to which they owe their very existence.
Exactly.
Oh, Trump has made a full court press through presidential executive orders to drive unions like the American Federation of Government Employees out of the federal workplace where they have been representing workers since 1962 when President Kennedy signed off on collective bargaining. These federal workers, many of whom are veterans, staff the Bureau of Prisons, the Veterans Administration, and dozens of other critical agencies. These are some of the same workers who were forced to work without pay for 35 days in 2018 and 19 by Trump because he wanted more money for a wall with Mexico, a wall he said Mexico would pay for. Throughout the pandemic, he's resisted providing testing for this essential workforce and failed to be transparent with just how many federal workers have died from the virus. He sided with meat producers over unions and local public health officials who wanted testing and disclosure of the results. Close to 200 workers died, including USDA inspectors. And then there is Trump's attempt to dismantle the U.S. Postal Service, one of the nation's most highly unionized enterprises that's also one of the largest employers of veterans. Exactly. It has not only helped knit the nation together with universal service, it has provided a path to the middle class for millions of people of color.
So let me just stop you for a second. So I am looking at this and you're saying, how can they support him, endorse him, when he is attacking unions, something that defines their very existence? They seem to think that they are different from the other unions. They seem to think, there's this, almost this idea, again, can we talk about, we talk about white privilege? I feel like we're now talking about, you know, cop privilege.
Right.
That they are in a class by themselves, that they will be protected, and that everybody else is expendable. Is this a wise strategy for the cops?
No, and I would suggest that the Democrats must take this contest into the PBA Union Hall. Do not write it off, because within all these organizations, especially the larger ones, you have an increasingly diverse workforce, especially over the last several years. And so you have to contest this. You have to bring it back to the occupational issues. And you have to remind them about just how bad Donald Trump has been before the pandemic on labor issues. I mean, he has been the most vehemently anti-labor president in the history of the Republic. And he's got some.
And I also said this to you before. We were talking about Missouri. The first black mayor,
Ferguson.
I apologize, everyone. So one of the things I'll never forget about Ferguson is that, you know, all these cops were stopping, and it seemed to be that they were stopping African-Americans and people that were clearly, obviously poor in order to fine them, you know, give them a ticket, do whatever. And people are saying, like, why would you do something so obvious? Because that was their revenue device to fund the cops. That every time they stopped someone and gave them a ticket, it went into the line item that supported them. How sick is that? I mean, that was literally setting them up to fail. They had an incentive to stop people because it was the way they got paid and the way they got benefits. And when you see that situation, that's another thing that undermines them, which if they were a union, they would say, I don't want this. I don't want to fund myself by stopping people. That's not how we should operate.
Well, and one of the problems has been they have been put in a position, and I've written a lot about this, across this country for decades now. We decided that we were no longer going to take care of the mentally ill with permanent facilities. So we basically closed mental health hospitals.
Yes.
And there were some egregious examples of abuse of individuals. And so we deinstitutionalized and never came up with the alternative, which was supposed to be group homes that were humane and community-based. We never did that. And so we literally have tens of thousands of individuals that we have cast out of society, wandering around in need of mental health help and of treatment, and we've left it to the police. Right. And this has been going on. These predated the pandemic. So I think that what you see is that they see the things that we choose not to see, and we pay them to keep them out of view.
Yeah, I can't believe we still have a whole page left, but I'm going to read your last line. And you write at the end, at its core, 2020 marks the culmination of an age-old tug of war for the soul of our nation between two competing worldviews, one rooted in fear and scarcity, the other in faith and abundance. And in a lot of ways, that's exactly what it is. And Donald Trump, who's sitting on lots of abundance, is telling you to worry about the scarcity, that there won't be enough for you. And that's exactly how his followers think. and they look at the other, whether it's an immigrant, whether it's a person of color, whether it's a female, whether it's whatever, and they are taking it from them, because that's the argument that Donald Trump is playing and is so successful with his base. Bob Hennelly, thank you so much. I'm sorry we didn't get to the whole article, but it covers so much territory. And now more than ever, we need to be covering these issues before we go into the voting booth in November.
So thanks for having me.
Can I ask you for your next article, think of, about maybe whether Trump's tearing apart the AFGE, the Government Workers Union, is going to cause a whole new period. Like when Reagan crushed PATCO, that really ushered in a terrible period.
I will tell you that, and you know who's someone that you should try to have on if you'd like to, I'd like to help you arrange it, Arnie, would be Dr. Everett Kelly, who is the president of the American Federation of Government Employees.
I would love to.
700,000. He's a minister. He comes out of the prophetic tradition of Dr. King, and he's just a very impressive person. And I'd be glad to put you in contact with him. They are holding up amazingly well, considering the assault they've been under. And one of the things that they're a pivotal union, because the 2018 swing that benefited the Democrats, when you drill down, it was the AFD's efforts, because they're present in every district. And they have cultivated a weird kind of bipartisan strategy over the years. Because, and that's what's so different about Donald Trump. There was a bipartisan consensus about the civil service that's existed my entire reporting career.
Wow.
And Donald Trump changed that. And he has, as Ken was saying, gone after the Merit Service Protection Board. He's tried to really mess with the architecture that keeps an apolitical, professional class of people doing the government's work.
And on that note, I need to let you go, because we're still recording this session, and I love this sidebar. This is the reason why you listen to The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes, because you start one place and you end another.
Thanks, guys.
You soon, bye. Take care. Bye-bye. Ciao.
There once was a union maid who never was afraid of the goons and the gangs and the company thinks and the deputy sheriff who made the raid. She went to the union hall when the meeting it was called, and when those company boys came round, she always stood her ground.
No, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union.
Guard, and this is what you say.
No, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the